Hello, everybody. This is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 48. We have an excellent guest, as we always do. Carrie Gunter Seymour is here, and she'll be joining us in just a moment. But before we begin, I should say Rattle is a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry and unaffiliated with any other organization. We just do this because we love poetry. Like everything else that we do, all we ask that you do is click the like button or the heart or whatever else you can click on wherever you're watching this or listening to this. And that really helps things spread around the world. If you're on iTunes, give us a rating too. We don't have all that many iTunes ratings. I want some more iTunes ratings. So if you're listening on iTunes, give us some stars. Now, the warm-up poem for today is going to be, I just clicked the random button as we usually do. And we got this poem by Lynn Thompson. And Lynn was the guest on Rattlecast number 2 way back in August, like August 1st last year, the second episode. We had Ben Alshire, then we had Lynn Thompson. She's a lawyer and a poet. Her most recent book is Fretwork, which is what we talked about then. This is from way back in 2005, our Tribute to Lawyer Poets issue, which was the summer 2005 issue. And excellent, excellent poems there by lawyers. Of course, lawyers are good with words. And this was Lynn Thompson's entry into that issue. This is Lament, I Am Implication. So here we go.
Lament, I am implication. An afterthought, meat gone rancid, Anna Karenina in blue hose, ephemerata. Every need I've declined to marry has failed me. Moonrise in the milksops I would have loved. Every daughter who could have been my revenge. Surprises have never been much of a surprise, and that has wrought thimbles of scandal. Also, wheelbarrows and Puccini, the Eucharist and television have all failed or been botched. It's getting on time, and I can't find one schnauzer who will nuzzle his constant heart in my lap. Someone in Kansas plays a Stradivarian dirge, but even those wry notes are much too sweet. My pigment drips more than Pollux. My hard history has been sung. See the palimpsest of my body, its full-length chiaroscuro laying stranded, lovely in its ruins.
Once again, that was Lament, I Am Implication by Lynn Thompson. I think that's from her first book, which I'm not remembering off the top of my head right now, but her newest book is Fretwork, so check that out. I love that line. Every need I've declined to marry has failed me. I always think about that. I don't know exactly what it means, but I love it. It's one of those lines that just sticks with you over the years, over 15 years in this case. Now, today's guest is Carrie Gunter Seymour. And we published her in Poets Respond back in 2014. She was actually the fourth poet we ever published in Poets Respond. And she's had an amazing month of success. She was named Ohio Poet of the Year for 2020 just now. And she was also named Ohio Poet Laureate over the last month. So congratulations, Carrie. She's a ninth generation Appalachian. Her work is firmly and unapologetically attached to her home soil and is an examination of the long-lasting effects of stereotype and false narratives surrounding Native Appalachians. Her current collection is A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. She's the founder, executive director of the Women of Appalachia Project, an arts organization she created to address discrimination directed at women from the Appalachian region. You can find that at womenofappalachia.com. She's also a retired instructor in the E.W. Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University, and a poem she wrote in support of families living in poverty in Athens County, Ohio, went viral and has been seen by over 100,000 people, resulting in thousands of dollars donated to her local food pantry. Find more at CarrieGunterSeymourPoet.com. That's Carrie with a K, K-A-R-I-G-U-N-T-E-R-S. E-Y-M-O-U-R, poet.com, if you could follow all that. If not, it's in the notes, of course, on the bottom of the podcast, wherever you're watching this. And here she is, Carrie Gunter Seymour. Hey, Carrie, how are you doing today?
Hey, Tim, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And first of all, congratulations on an amazing month of confirmation for all you've been doing over the last, you know, several years of working in poetry.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you want to start us out with a poem? Get the ball
I'd love
rolling?
to. Sure.
Okay.
As you mentioned, my newest collection is called A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. So I'd like to read the anchor poem from
Yeah,
that.
that's a great way, place to start for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, and
I come.
what page is it on so I
Oh,
can flip a
sorry.
page?
Oh, I'm
Yeah,
sorry.
I forgot to remind you.
17.
17. Okay.
17. But I know this. I don't know why. I'm
Oh,
misbehaving
it's
already.
hard. There's so much to try to remember. It's tough.
I had no alcohol tonight, I promise you.
Okay.
Okay. I come from a place so deep inside America it can't be seen. White oaks thrash. Moonlight drifts the ceiling as if I'm underwater. Propane coils, warms my bones. Gone are the magics and all the songs. All the things our grandmothers buried, piles of feathers and angel bones, inscribed by all who came before. When I was 12, my cousins called me ugly, enough to make it last. Tonight, a celebrity on Oprah imagines a future where features can be removed and replaced on a whim. A moth presses wings thin as paper against my window, more beautiful than I could ever be. Ryegrass raise seedy heads beyond the bull thistle and preen. Everything alive aches for more.
I love that ending. And I love the title too, which is something I mentioned last time, but that's just such a memorable title and such a great description of it that can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that? Like, why is it a place so deep inside America it can't be seen?
Well, because I'm going to get into it now, if that's all right
Yeah,
with
get
you.
into it. Yeah,
Okay,
let's do it.
so let's just talk about it. So today, and for well over a century, Appalachians have been marginalized and stereotyped, and it's affected, multiple generations. And it was intended to dehumanize us and belittle us, so that the U.S. coal companies could come in and, extract the coal from our land. And they did. And at that time, Appalachians were beginning to be characterized as barefoot, overfed, undergroomed, undereducated, basically white trash. And it's easier for the coal companies to pull off the ruse that they're helping Appalachia rather than plundering Appalachia with all of that going on. So just keep in mind, that's just the one story, right? That's just the one story about Appalachia. So then in the 1950s, the coal industry collapsed. That was the mountaintop mining, and a lot of even the underground mining, because they had just really mined the heck out of Appalachia. And so they just pulled out, and Appalachia became this huge junkyard. Okay, so they just literally up and moved out, and a lot of the machinery they didn't need or was getting older or whatever, they simply left it in place, and they just simply took off. No severance, no notice, really. And they left workers without jobs. Okay. So it's not like they could go back to farming, because the land had all been ruined. There was no topsoil. There was just no way for anybody to go back to farming, because everybody sort of knew how to do that, right? Okay, so needless to say, Appalachia fell into deep poverty at that time. And again, that's kind of where some of that story comes back in again, about everybody being undergroomed and underfed and, just not in a good way. So in 1964, Lyndon Johnson decides to declare a war on poverty. And of course, it was aimed at Appalachia. And a lot of that was due to some really beautiful photography done by people like Shelby Adams and John Domenis and in Life magazine. And so those photographs are what people think. That's the first thing that comes to someone's mind when they think about Appalachia. And that whole sort of fabrication was made up, by the coal companies. We have to keep that in mind. So when you think about the war on poverty, what that did is it provided programs to feed people, but nothing for education, really what all that it did was serve to keep Appalachians from starving, but what it did do is remove all sense of pride or hope, you know, for the future. So that's the stereotype of the barefoot, poor, white hillbilly, trailer trash is something that is familiar to most Americans, and it's a myth, and it conceals race and racism in Appalachia, and that's what I mean mm-hmm. when I say I live in a place so deep inside America it can't be seen, because everybody keep wanting to look at that one story. They don't want to look at all the other stories. We are so complex. We have beautiful stories. We are beautiful people. Our roots are so deeply buried. We love our families. We love the land. We are honorable people, and that's very important to us, to be honorable. And we look to our elders passed down over the generations.
Okay. So can you repeat what you just said, the last sentence or two? Because it froze for a second.
Okay, I'll just kind of start with, I just hope people will look beyond that one mm-hmm. single story, because we are much more than that one story. There's much to be admired about us. We're tenacious. We're strong in spirit. We love family. We love the land. We're a very honorable people. That is so important to us, to be honorable, and the very things that have sustained us for generations. And those who came before us, lending us their honor and their strength and their courage, has helped us survive. And I would really suggest to people who truly want to find out more about Appalachia and the stereotype and the marginalization to watch a documentary entitled Hillbilly. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful documentary, award-winning, I might add, many awards, by Ashley York and Sally Rubin. And it is... it is very eye-opening and quite wonderful, but it's like most documentaries, it can be a little difficult to watch. Mm-hmm. But the truth is the truth, you know.
So. Yeah, I was going to suggest two documentaries actually too. Harlan County, USA, about the strike mm-hmm. for coal miners was such a just an amazing documentary. I think it won. Yes. I think maybe the Sundance, or something like that, best documentary maybe 10 years ago. And then the other thing I watched, I don't really have much experience with Appalachia. I drove through one time. And that's about it on my way to Florida. And I knew I had a friend actually that I worked with. And the very top of Appalachia is the southern tier of New York. And a friend of mine, mm-hmm. I worked with him on a landscaping crew for my summer job one year. He'd drive all the way up from the southern tier, 2 hours every day. And he was just such a character. I loved him. But the other thing I was going to say is Anthony Bourdain's episode of Parts Unknown on Appalachia. What an amazing! I mean, I had tears in my eyes watching that. It was an amazingly rich and nuanced look at the culture there. So I recommend everybody watch those. We have three documentaries that were assignments to do. But this is probably a good time to mention. We're going to do a tribute issue to Appalachian poets, and it's going to be next summer's issue. I just added it to Submittable, and I'll put it up on screen really quick so people can see. But this is going to be the summer 2021 issue. Issue number 72 of Rattle is going to be a tribute to Appalachian poets. And like everything that we do, every tribute theme, the idea is to just explore what poets from a certain region or with something in common are doing. And to sort of have an open-ended look at a certain cultural characteristic. And so anybody who's an Appalachian poet can submit. Please do, if anybody's watching now that's eligible. You just have to consider yourself an Appalachian poet. Have lived there a certain length of time enough to, qualify and make sense. But we won't check your driver's license or anything. And then send whatever you're sending, unpublished poems, up to 4. And the deadline's going to be January 15th, 2021 for that summer issue. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's an issue that we've been planning on doing for a long time. And so when you came on, it was the time of the year to pick this issue. And I figured it was a perfect timing to do that issue. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yay. And Tim, could I just mention, Appalachia isn't confined by its 420 counties, because so many people migrated out, mm-hmm. starting with the end of the war, and especially with the coal mines pulling out. Mm-hmm. So we've got pockets of Appalachians all over the country. So to say that you have to live in Appalachia, you might want to reconsider that.
You had to live there at some point, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Or your people.
Yeah. I guess we could say that too. Yeah. Yeah. If you identify as something, that's all we care about. We don't check your credentials to see if it's good enough. There's no line. It's just if you consider yourself Appalachian, you fit. But you do have to sort of, you know, say, because some people will get submissions, honestly, where people will say, you know, I lived there for a month once. and you know, I have no other connection whatsoever. But here's a poem I wrote for the month that I lived in West Virginia. And then, no. So,
yeah. Don't you think the work will kind of speak for itself? I think you're going to know. I think we're going to blow you away is what I think is going to happen. I think you're just going to be amazed. And I think you might have to double the size of Rattle for that issue, because you're going to pick so many beautiful poems. You're not going to be able to contain it in the
that's
one.
That's awesome. Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait. I definitely cannot. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for getting the ball rolling on this. I really appreciate it. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you do with the women, what is the organization called?
Women of Appalachia Project.
Women of Appalachia Project. Yeah. What is it that you do with that?
I would love to. I'll give you a little bit of background. Obviously, I'm Appalachian, and I have been so lucky all my life. I mean, I literally, my life is kind of crazy. I can tell you a little bit about my people later, but I came stumbling out of a holler as a, trying to remember how old I was. I believe I was 33. And ended up in Athens, Ohio. I didn't come that far, don't get me wrong. And realized pretty quickly I needed to enroll in college, so I did, with a lot of help from a lot of people. And that doesn't happen very often to a single mother, single Appalachian mothers. And so a lot of people worked really hard to help me out. And when I graduated, I got a job right away, which was also very, very lucky. But what surprised me was the way people made fun of me, the way I talked, because I have a little bit of a twang now because I'm working real hard to get it back. But when I read my poems, you hear my real twang.
Oh, and I love it. There's such musicality to it. It's one of the things. The first time I heard you read, I thought, wow, that's beautiful.
Well, and that's my people, because when I write, I do hear that. I hear that, you know, as I'm writing. And then I started submitting, you know, I started writing poetry and doing some photography and submitting, and I was getting back these weird rejections, like trying too hard to be ethnic or a little on the colorful side or something like that, that indicated to me that they were just being a little bit, I don't know, picky. I don't know what the word is. And maybe my stuff was just really bad. I mean, it could have been really bad, but I decided I'm a marketing communications person. I can organize an art show. I can organize a poetry reading. So I did. And I approached Ohio University, a woman named Chenu, Winsome Chenu, and she's the director of the Multicultural Center. And I made a pitch that Appalachian women are, a marginalized culture. And she agreed to try it once. And we had 5 fine artists and 4 poets. We're entering the 12th year. We're now a 501c3 nonprofit. We have trademark for the Women of Appalachia Project. We've had hundreds of women participate from throughout, oh gosh, I think 15 states now. Every year we go from venues throughout Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky and read our work. And I also publish it in an anthology called Women Speak. And this is the 5th anthology that I've edited and published. And if anybody's interested, you can buy this from Mountain State Press. That's pretty easy to Google to find it. 80 fine. There's fine art and there's spoken word inside this beautiful book.
It is a beautiful book, I have to say. Yeah, it's a great cover.
It is a truly beautiful. Yeah, thank you. That's my design, but not my photograph. So I have to give Jessica Malone, the photo credit. But what we do, what the whole point is we're activists, yes, but we're non-confrontational. We simply speak our work. We hang our work in galleries. And we allow those who see it or hear it to respond to it. And we are in academic settings. So we go to Berea, Kentucky. We go to Northern Kentucky University. We go to West Virginia University, Morgantown. I'm going to forget a whole bunch of them. But anyway, we go round about. And so you'd be surprised, especially in academia, how little they know about Appalachia, even though they're living there. And so it's been really, really exciting. But the very best part of it is the sisterhood that has developed. I've never, ever felt less alone in my entire life than I do right now. And I've met the most amazing, amazing women and their families. And whenever one of us falls, there's 100 people to pick you up and dust you off and tell you, okay, you just start again. When you're ready, you start again, and we're all standing there with you. We practice with each other. We do all kinds of things just to lift each other up and make ourselves better. And we have all become better. And we've had, oh my goodness, Prindy winners. Many of us have been nominated for push carts. And we have a Pulitzer Prize winning photographer who participates. I mean, this is a pretty big deal, you know. So we're really proud of it, and it's just a big old bunch of women who just care. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad you could do that. I cannot wait to read the submissions that come in for this issue coming up. Do you want to read a couple more poems from either whatever
sure,
you want to
I'd
do?
Love yeah. To. I'd love to. I'll read another one from a place so deep. Mm-hmm. This one's called Ruby May, and it's on page 29. Mm-hmm. You let me know when you're ready.
Ahead.
Okay. Oh, I should tell you. I made some little notes here because I wanted to remember to tell you all these things. So, in this little book, there's many characters, and so I've taken stories from people I know or in my family or and a kind of. Have taken liberties. So to kind of give you an idea of how I do that, my maternal grandmother's name is Ruby, and my mother's middle name is May. So now I've created Ruby May, right? Mm-hmm. And another character in the book is Fanny June. So my step-grandmother was named Fanny, and my birth month is June. So there's Fanny June. So maybe Fanny June and me and Fanny June are a little bit alike, and my mama and her mama were a little bit alike. And then those stories that kind of twine in and out. So just kind of give you an idea of how things are happening here. So Ruby May. My mama hates children and dogs, even her own. No matter that she makes this clear, announces it regular. Wherever she goes, there's a child or hound set to wallow her as if she smells of jelly beans or Alpo. Manic, she will coo you penniless. Depressed, she'll peel the skin off your face with nary a whip of her curly head. Now, she says, I wanted to live seemly. I set out to be kind. Reaches for her Bible. She says Uncle Bub used to tickle her up under her chin, and otherwise on whiskey nights. She says she and Fanny June would build forts with kitchen chairs and Grammy's star flower quilt, crawl deep inside, lure the cat with baloney, lie side by side, lock fingers in a pinky swear, hearts crossed. Hoped he'd die.
That was Ruby May from A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. You want to do another one?
Sure. So I guess I need to talk about the grandmothers, how important our grandmothers are to us. And so many of us have lost our grandmothers, you know, and with that goes so much information. And I think anytime we lose somebody, we remember all the things we wish we would have asked them, right? So I'm going to read As the Twig is Bent on page 20.
Go ahead.
Okay. As the twig is bent, honeysuckle spiked early this year. The dogwood leaved by only half. My grandmother would say these are signs of consequence. The significance long lost to me with many mountain ways. My red-handled shovel offers up a smooth white pebble I place on my tongue. Tasting of storm. Of dusty teacups, a revelation between clenched teeth. Shoulders hunched, my body is a poem of rusty spine and thinning blood, words piled 100 apologies deep. Generations pass, and still we toil, scratch at scars, lose track of the path home. A downy woodpecker probes a sculpted trunk. Clouds swell. The rain stings.
That was As the Twig is Bent, from A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. The newest book from Carrie Gunter Seymour, Ohio Poet Laureate. Do you want to talk? I'm curious about how you started writing poetry. Because I read somewhere, and maybe it was a bio or a press release, that the poetry came to you when your son went to fight in the Middle East. And that it sort of saved you. It was something to write, something to do. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why did you come to poetry?
Yeah, I was a mess when my son deployed, especially the first time, because it was early. It was Fallujah. It was terrible. There was no email. If he was to call me, he had to wait in line for 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes to be able to call home. And it was often in the middle of the night because they're 12 hours and a little some different from us. So I wasn't sleeping. I'd wake up every morning and wonder if he was even living, you know, because I wouldn't know till I didn't or did get a phone call. So I started journaling. And then someone said, you ought to write poetry because it'll help you focus in, and maybe that would be more therapeutic for you to be able to do that instead of these ramblings, which are obviously making me more crazy, right? So I did that, and what it did, this is going to sound kind of hokey, but what it did is it did make me focus in and think about every word I wrote. And I will tell you, the very first ones were horrible. They really were. But what it made me do is realize that you can't ask the Lord to save somebody's life and then not believe they're going to do it. I mean, faith is faith. If I was going to ask the Lord to save my son's life, then I had to believe he was going to do it, and I had to start behaving that way. And so it did save me in the sense that it just really made me think very deeply about what I was writing and why I was writing it and what the significance and importance was of every word I was placing on the page instead of these wild ramblings, which were literally just making me feel more wild. Mm. So, yeah, that's kind of the story. That's where it got started.
Do you think of, since you mentioned the Lord, do you think of poems as prayers? That's one of the things I always think of poems might be, as a kind of prayer to the unknown or to God, if, you know, is that something you think of it?
I think many of the prayers then were, and I think the prayers in my first little chapbook the poems are probably more prayers than maybe some in this one. Although some of these, I think some of the ones in here could be considered prayer-like. I think, yes, now that you mention it, I think I'm a prayer without even knowing it, maybe.
Well, I think so, too. I just think that there's, you know, there's the mystery of the universe, and you're sort of putting out, you're sort of trying to communicate with that void that doesn't speak back or something. There's some way that you're doing that presence that is the world, and it's hard to speak to in your own words, you know, and then poetry gives you your own words to speak to it. That's kind of one thing I've always felt when it comes to poetry.
No, I agree with you. And I also feel like every time a poem is given to me, because that is how I feel, so there's that spirituality again, I feel like it's a miracle. I do. I don't mean to sound corny again, but I do. I'm so grateful for every poem that's given to me, even the bad ones, you know, because I just know if I go back to those in a few months or a year, it'll, you know, it'll probably turn out to be an okay poem. So I'm just grateful that I could just take up poetry like that and it would come to me. I just think that's a miracle and a gift. You know, that's a gift from whoever, I don't mean to force the Lord on anyone, but whoever you believe in or whatever you believe in, to be given a gift such as that is to be able to put these words together on a page and then to have some people actually like them. Wow. I mean, that's really something, you know, that's just something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What was your process like for learning how to write poems? Because you said it started out as journal entries. Did you read certain poets? Did you take classes? What did you do to start crafting them into poems?
A little bit of both of those. I remember reading Triggering Town. Is that right? Am I saying that right? Yeah, Triggering Town is one of my first books. And then just started reading lots of poets. Then I started trying to attend some workshops. And I think the pivot for me was when I, as far as improvement goes, was when I started attending the Heinemann week-long writer's workshop in Heinemann, Kentucky, which is at the Heinemann Settlement School, which is older than trees in that area. I mean, it's really awesome, a place. And the kind of people that hang out there, I've studied under Rebecca Gale Howe. Silas House is there all the time. I don't know, these may be names you don't know because they're Appalachian.
Oh, Rebecca Gay Howell, we know. She
Yeah,
we had a poem of
sure.
hers in the Pushcart Anthology, and it was a the Reader's Choice Award winner for the Rattle Poetry Prize.
Was that my mother said I should never have children,
It
maybe?
was, yes, it was. Yeah, it's
Yes,
one of my
yes,
favorite poems. It's a
yes,
wonderful one,
yes.
yeah.
Yes, and she's a marvelous person, just a marvelous person. And I was had the great fortune to study under her and hang out with people. Like I can go through the whole list now if you want me to, real quick, to tell you the kind of people I've been able to hang out with. Marianne Worthington from Still the Journal. She published my very first poem, and to my mind, Still the Journal is one of the finest Appalachian journals you will ever find. And it is an online journal, and it's free to read. And I know they want to try to keep it that way. So if you've got a little spare change to send their way, if you read and like what you read, I think that would be wonderful. And Marianne Worthington is an amazing poet herself. There's Rita Quillen, Pauletta Hansel out of Cincinnati, Ohio. She is the editor of Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel. I have some of these. Here's Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel. Huge book, gives opportunity to so many Appalachian writers, not just poets, but essayists and storytellers and songwriters. And there's even been a map in it a couple of times that people have drawn of the artists that live in Appalachia, and that's Pauletta Hansel. She's the immediate past poet laureate for Cincinnati, Ohio, and she won the Weatherford Award for her writing.
Yeah, we published her too just last
Yes.
year. And I was about to post it today, and then I posted your poem, and so I'm going to post it tomorrow as the last week's poem on Facebook and Twitter and stuff. But yeah, that I Confess poem, which is one of the most read poems of the year last year, if I remember right. Yeah, Pauletta.
Yes. Yeah, she's amazing. Again, an amazing woman, just an amazing woman. Bianca X, formerly Bianca Spriggs, who is one of our fabulous Afro-Latian poets. Michael Henson is a poet out of Cincinnati, doing some amazing writing. Robert Guipe is actually a novelist, but his writing is so lyrical and so full of music that I think of it as this big long prose poem. His writing is so amazing. There's Linda Parsons and Stella Sue Lee, who you know
I do
and
know
is
her.
dear to me, and they're out of Nashville, doing some amazing work. Thomas Allen Holmes, excuse me, Thomas Allen Holmes. Richard Haag, Jane Waldrop, Savannah Sipple out of Kentucky. She's one of our outstanding LGBTQ poets. Val Nieman out of North Carolina. And last but not least, I've already talked about Rebecca Gale Howe, but Crystal Wilkinson. Oh, sweet Lord, you do want to read her work. It's just amazing. And both she and Rebecca have won the United States Artist Fellowship. And if you don't know what that is, it's an amazing, prestigious award. And they are given $50,000 to do with as they wish to just work on their poetry, which in Appalachia, that could be actually two salaries for an entire year. So, and I've only touched the surface. These are just some of the people that I know. There are so many, and I'm just so excited for everyone who's listening tonight or may listen to this in the future to look up some of these poets as well. Oh, I forgot one more. This is the Anthology of Appalachian Writers. This is from Shepherd University, and Dr. Sylvia Sherbert is the editor of this. And again, like this particular volume was dedicated to Crystal Wilkinson, but there's writing from just literally a couple hundred of Appalachian writers. And there's also some art in here, and some of my photography's in here, so I'll brag that up a little bit. But again, you can just get this from Shepherd EDU. and you can order this beautiful book. And again, you will laugh, you will cry, you will maybe change your mind about what you think about Appalachians once you read some of this work, because it's not an easy life. It is often a very hard life for Appalachians.
Yeah, well, it's interesting hearing you list the names, because there's a whole lot of poets that we've published in Rattle that I didn't know or think of as Appalachian poets. I don't really look where they are and think of it that way usually, but so this is gonna be really cool to do. I should say before we go on with some more poems, if anybody has any questions for Carrie Gunter Seymour, please just leave them in the chat window and I'll pass them along either on YouTube or Facebook. I'm watching both. We got a good question already. We'll do that next. But do you want to read a couple more poems, Carrie?
Sure. Well, what I thought I might do is read a couple of the poems that have some music in it, because I cannot even emphasize enough how important music is to us. And I'll tell you what, families can be feuding and, you know, lovers can be quarreling, but the fiddle comes out, the banjo, the guitar, and everybody's going to church right that minute. You know what I mean? I mean, everybody's getting along and tapping their feet, and it's a beautiful thing. And I do think music does heal us, and it's another spiritual experience, and it's another form of prayer, I think. So anyway, I wrote this poem for my daddy, and he was a big old Hank Williams fan, and I was watching the Ken Burns documentary on country music, and when it came to the Hillbilly Shakespeare, which is Hank Williams, it was very emotional for me, and this poem just came. It's one of those ones where you write it down, and the next day you tweak it a couple times, and it was done. And so I thought, I wonder if my daddy sent this to me. Anyway, it's called Hank Williams' Last Ride. And also, there's a little story in here. There's historical information, and that often ends up in my poems, too. So it's on 30. I'm sorry. Page 30. So Hank Williams' Last Ride. I knew all the words to move it on over before I could walk properly. Daddy loved Hank, and that was good enough for me. Move over, skinny dog, 'cause a fat dog's moving in. My toddler melodies hitting every trill and dip. Daddy strumming G, C, G, D. His foot a thumping tick hound, scratching fleas. He died hard, my daddy. Not like Hank, addicted to morphine and booze, but he was blue, and Hank knew the blues. Tonic tunes, Daddy called them. What might his life have been if he'd played honky-tonks instead of signing up for a front-row seat in the Pacific Ocean Theater, thick with Japs and dead brothers? Or better still, if he'd not come home with a metal plate in his head and coal being the only means to make a living wage in the mountains? What might Hank's life have been if his heart had not given out? If he'd never checked in at the Andrew Johnson Hotel and Charles' car moved on over so my daddy could drive to Canton, not far from the foothills of the Appalachians, where I sat singing all sass and twang as if somebody's life depended on it.
Yeah, and that was Hank Williams' Last Ride from A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. You've mentioned a few times sort of poems being channeled from somewhere. What is your process like? Like how do you find that channel? Because, you know, most everybody watching this is a poet themselves and wants to figure out how it works. How does it work for you? Like, what do you do to get into that space where the poem is coming from somewhere else, which I think is a space that we all feel when we do it right?
I have to wait for my poems. I can't sit down every morning and write. I can sit down every morning and review poems and work on them and update them or, you know, revise them. But until the poem's ready to come, it just doesn't come to me. But I could be standing in the garden and all of a sudden it'll hit me. And I kind of have to run for a piece of paper or get up to my computer so that I can do it. Sometimes I have to put them on my phone, you know. But that's how they come to me. They're just kind of like, here I am, write me down. And it's not, I don't want to say that it's that comes to me that easy, because it does not, believe me. But the structure of it usually does. I'm going to quote Maggie Smith here. It has good bones until I get back in there to fix it up. But the idea of the poem comes to me pretty, At least the start and the finish may be pretty clearly, and what comes in between, I have to allow my whatever that is to coax itself out, you know. I do try to free write quite a bit, just to sit down and free write with a pencil on a notebook about these things that are in my head, and that helps quite a bit too, because lots of times if I can just get myself to free write like a half hour or 35, 40 minutes, and I go back, I find a lot of what the poem is right in there. I just have to excavate it out, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's kind of my process.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never, you know, Good Bones, if nobody knows that poem by Maggie Smith, it's about how life has good bones and we can, you know, that we can build around as if we're looking at a piece of real estate. It has stuff to work with. I never thought of it, though, as a poem about writing, but it works so well. That never occurred to
it
me.
Does.
It really does.
Yeah.
really quick, Vicky Miko asks if you write songs, too. Do you write song lyrics since you...
I have written song lyrics, and I love to sing. I love to sing. When I was younger, I wrote a lot of song lyrics. I haven't recently. I'm not even sure why. I guess because the poetry over just came upon me. You know, it's like a laying of hands, you know. Poetry laid its hands on me, and I've got to do that now until something else lays its hands on me, you know. And again, I feel so blessed. And I guess, too, I haven't been as active in the church as I was as a young person, and there was much, much more singing going on in my life at that time than there is now. I have to kind of create my own singing now. Mm-hmm. But I have written some lyrics, yes. Yeah,
well, I'm so glad that poetry's laid its hands on you. That's a great way to put it, too. Tucker Pavlak says, can you tell us something about forgiveness and letting go of attachment?
Oh, boy, can I. I wonder if I should read some poems about that. That kind of gets back to the discussion I was having about finding my faith. When you have a loved one in harm's way for as long and as many times as I did, you have to start forgiving people. You know, you can't blame his lieutenant and you can't blame his captain and you can't, you know, you can blame the president. I'm okay with that. but you just have to find a way. And by doing that, you become a better person. I think you just become a better human being. And I'll give another example. My mother is one of those who died in the nursing home recently. Mm-hmm. And I was only allowed in to see her for not a very long time before she passed. And I actually missed her passing because they would not let me back in. And I could have been really mad. And I could have thrown a fit. And I could have tried to sue somebody. And what I did is we were under orders. The people were trying to keep everybody there safe, including my mother, who did not contract. Nobody there has had COVID-19. And I found gratitude in the care they had given her all the years she'd been there and all the care they had given me while I came there and spent time with them. And they treated me like family. And I started thinking about all that. And then I was able to let go of all the nastiness of that, and so I could still make it a beautiful passing. Mm-hmm. You know, I could still make that. I could still find the beauty in all of that, and I could let go of that and not have it torture me for the rest of my life, because that there's no service, there's no purpose in that. So that's how I try to find a way to let go, and I have written those into my poems. As you know, I wrote one about my mother being in the nursing home. I had shared that on the open mic, you know, and lo and behold, it was only a few weeks later that she passed. But I guess because I've gotten older, and I guess because I found that faith when my son was deployed, it's the most amazing thing. And I just wish that for everybody. And I'm not saying I'm born again. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to baptize y'all. I'm just saying that having a way to find the goodness in even mm-hmm. the worst situation sounds like such a Pollyanna thing to say, but it really is. We spend way too much time on things that we are never going to bring any change to or conclusion. Mm-hmm. there's a whole lot of better things to exert your energy on that we can bring change to, you know, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us right now on change that needs to happen. So I hope that answers the question.
I think it does. And, it's talking about just religious faith. The one thing that I think we're really lacking maybe is just the idea of that we're all sinners struggling. It's something that we've sort of lost. I'm not a really religious person, but I love the way that thinking of the world that way and thinking of people as struggling through moral problems and trying to find the right path and failing. But it allows you to have empathy and find solace with people a lot more than if you think that we're all, that some of us can be perfect, you know? Like just the idea that we can be morally pure is a problem, I think, that we think that way rather than thinking that we're all struggling.
Exactly. And I try to think about that when I go to the grocery store and someone treats me real mean or gets in front of me or whatever. I just try to think, oh, man, I wonder if she had trouble getting her kids ready for school this morning, or maybe she's got a sick child at home and she's trying to get there quick, you know, those kind of things, you know, just to and maybe I'm just a fool and that's okay, too. I don't care if I am because I'm a happy one.
Yeah, it just makes you feel better about the world to think of it that way, even though it's such a negative concept, the concept of everybody being a sinner, but the actual like pragmatic result of that is that you can forgive so much more easily. I mean, you mentioned the grocery store, and that right now the mask thing between like, do we wear a mask? And I just have such sort of anger at the people who don't, you know, when there's people that are vulnerable walking around next to them but then realizing that people are trying to, you know, struggle through and do the right thing. Like they're trying to do the right thing too, even though I think it's the wrong thing and they think I'm doing the wrong thing. And thinking that way just makes it much more of a peaceful experience confronting people at the grocery store. It really does.
It does. And I think confrontation is not all it's chalked up to be. You know, because if you're going to confront, then you have to be willing to concede, or you don't come to, you know, you don't come to consensus. So there's no sense confronting someone if you're not willing to work with them, you know, to compromise in some way. And if you're setting out to put somebody down for not wearing a mask and you're not going to budge, then there's really no sense to confront because there's not going to be any peaceful solution to that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, you mentioned you had some poems about this, about, you know, forgiveness, or I can't remember how he put it, but do you want to share a poem or two in that vein?
Well, what I might share is the anchor poem from the chapbook, which I think kind of speaks to all that we've been talking about tonight, maybe. So I'd like to first say that any of my poems that I read from this chapbook, this is page 3. I always send out to all who have served, are serving, and to their families. But this is a time when I will mention that food is very important to Appalachians. We take great pride in our food. We have secret recipes that we tell no one. They stay in the family. For us, sharing food it unites us. It's like a higher power for us, because I think what it is it's just such a family thing to do, to share food, even with strangers. You know, there's kind of a spiritualness about that. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll just read this poem. It's called Serving. Remember that time your dog died, and I didn't tell you for months because you had deployed and George Bush was shouting, "Bring it on," and we were all thinking Korea was fixing to blow. But when I emailed to say we were headed for West Virginia, you fired back, "Mom, where's Annie?" And I had to say she was hit by a car. I sent brownies loaded with black walnuts from the old home place. Or when you called me from Iraq asking me to talk to people about donating shoes, and I told you it was hopeless because of the tsunami, everyone was already donating, and you said hell with that. And your unit threw in their paychecks and bought all those families just outside Fallujah new shoes off the internet. I made 200 popcorn balls wrapped in wax paper. Or that February you came home for R&R so sad and sick. I baked your favorite, meatloaf, and you said you couldn't possibly, but I gave you dough eyes, so you ate and threw up all night long into the next day, saying over and over, "Sweet Jesus, please make it stop. And I knew you weren't talking about the meatloaf. Or the day after Sergeant Crabtree went to Vegas and blew his head off in the hotel bathroom while here at home your best friend got arrested for selling narcotics, and you said neither one of them needed to, maybe wouldn't have if you'd been there. So I shipped molasses cookies thick with Crisco frosting all the way to Kandahar. Or the afternoon your farm boy fingers tried to clamp the artery on that precious baby girl near the valley of Argon Dob, while her father screamed for Allah and blood soaked your uniform when you hugged her to you as she passed. I drenched that fruitcake in brandy for 3 days. But mostly, it was the night your daughter was born, and we locked eyes across the birthing room, and I thought to myself, skillet fried chicken with candied sweet potatoes, fried okra, lima beans with bacon, cornbread, and Aunt Margaret's hot fudge cake. We used the good dishes, and Grandpa Orr said the blessing. When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah. Hurrah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes marching home.
Oh, that was beautiful. Thanks so much. That was Serving, the title poem from Carrie Gunter Seymour's first chapbook. Or I don't know if it's your first chapbook, but
it is my first,
yeah,
yes.
Serving here. I'm so glad you read that. That was one of my favorite poems in the book. That meatloaf, that whole stanza was so touching in particular. Beautiful singing, too. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
We did have a request. I don't know if you have... I didn't see it in the book, but maybe I just missed it. The Trouble with Apples?
I could bring it up and read it.
Yeah, someone requested that. Daniel Mask requested that, so.
Just give me 1 minute to get my website up here, and it's right on my website.
And that is Carrie Gunter Seymour, poet.com.
Yes. Okay, here we go. Uh-oh. Yeah, there it is. Sometimes I told you, Tim, our internet gets a little funky sometimes. Okay. This is the trouble with apples. We might should blame Eve or that rascal Newton. But I say it was Gessler, bastard. Though who could have known what would come of his vengeance, Tell's defiance, his son's famous stance. This perfectly delicious one, grievously balanced, shadow-shaped, cloud guts, pithy and sweet, spewed, insides out, beyond freckled skin, shards and debris making slick work of that steel, that lead, spinning fast and true. That silly boys would forever set one to head, aim whatever, egged on by the romance of muscle and munitions, killing fruit, then birds, then animals, then each other.
Another good one. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for the request, Daniel Musk. I appreciate that.
Yes.
There was another question that was interesting. Let me see if I can find it again. It was Tucker Pavlak. And he says, she will understand, how do we always find each other?
Oh, he's a veteran. I don't know. I don't know how that happens, but it happens to me over and over and over. And I'm really glad I found you and you found me. I'm really glad of that. I hope you'll reach out to me. I wish I knew the answer to that, except that I think that we all have that hole in us that is so trying to be filled. And the best way to do that is with each other, I guess. The more we talk about it, the more we heal, maybe. So I think that's another one of those spiritual things that maybe whoever you believe in, the universe, the Lord, whoever, that that we're allowed to find each other for that very reason. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that question, and thank you for, I hope I haven't misstepped by making that proclamation. But I am really glad that we have found each other.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad too. I'll copy this and then maybe delete. I think he gave his phone number. I'll copy this and put it in a file, and then I'll delete it so nobody else can see his phone number.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was this poem that you published that went viral, and it had something to do with a food bank. What's the story with that?
Okay, so Joe Burrow is our boy. He is our man. You know, he's the Heisman Trophy winner. Do you know that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you know that about him? Okay, I wasn't sure.
No, I'm a football fan, so yeah.
Okay, so you know, this young man just is a gorgeous, wonderful human being. There's just no other way around it, and he's super talented. But he was also a great, you know, academic. And when he got up on that stage and made his acceptance speech, he mentioned that there were a whole lot of kids in Athens County who were doing without, and that he felt so grateful, and that he always thought about them, you know, as he made his way through life. A friend of his put up a Facebook GoFundMe sort of Facebook ask, and people started donating. And they were near the end of it, and the donations had kind of quit. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm in the last month of my poet laureateship here in Athens, Ohio, I guess, or Athens County, I said. And I said, I guess I wouldn't be much of a poet laureate if I didn't write a poem about Joe Burrow. But I don't watch football, and I don't know anything about Joe Burrow football that way. You know, I don't know, you know, I know he's the quarterback. But anyway, I did write a poem from my heart, because I have been very poor, and I know what it's like to be poor, and I simply wrote a poem about what it's like to be poor and what it's like for children to be poor, and I just sent it to my local newspaper, and we put it up, and people just went nuts over it, and started sending in money to finish up the fundraiser, and $500,000 was collected for our food pantry in, you know, Athens County, Ohio. It's just another one of those miracles. So the title is Go Joe, but it's written in, you know, the Louisiana French, because, you know, that's where he was playing, is LSU. So the title is Go Joe. Okay. Until you fed your kids Kraft mac and cheese from the markdown bin at the dollar store for the sixth time in 2 weeks, made with water instead of milk. Worried sick about what's happening to their insides, a dented can of carrots past the expiration date of luxury. Until you've worked two jobs and still can't climb above the food stamp line, never mind proper heating or running water. And you put your six-year-old to bed hungry again, wondering if there's any way you can take on a third job and still see your kids. Until your daughter asks to pack her lunch because she's made fun of for being subsidized. So in desperation, you take time off work to stand in the food pantry line in the cold, children in tow, only to be informed it was a tough week for the pantry, too. Until you've put your children on the school bus dressed in mended clothes from the new to you, sized for children meant to be more filled out, and they're labeled white trash and no amount of scrubbing can remove that stain. And dreams of college remain just that. Until a boy from your neighborhood picks up a football and throws it so far, thousands of people notice, and thousands more will eat high on the hog, because the proof of a person lies in their honor, and glory rests not in the moment, but extends itself in supplication.
Oh, that was wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad we could. It's amazing when a poem, you know, does something meaningful in the world, which is a weird thing to say, but you know, to work on a mass level rather than the one-on-one level that poetry usually operates on is really cool to see anytime it does. So that's a really cool story.
Thank you. I just feel like I'm just happen to be in the right place at the right time. I really do. Because, you know, as Appalachians, we're taught not to be briggity, because every time you get lifted up, there's thousands of other people who work just as hard as you, or maybe harder than you, that are not being lifted up. And you just need to remember that. So you just don't want to go there, you know. You just want to keep your feet right on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks, Carrie. We have maybe time for one last poem to close it out. Is there one you wanted to end on?
There is. It's on page 18.
Okay.
The Weeds in This Garden.
A Place So Deep?
Yes, okay. A Place So Deep. Okay. I'm so sorry. The Weeds in This Garden. Long ago, I built a self outside myself. I ate what my family ate, answered to my name. But when they said, let us pray, I kept my eyes open. There is a price to be paid for resistance. Whatever you call me, I have called myself worse. Invented words made up of letters from my own name. Now the backs of my hands, all bone and strain, I think cannot be mine. Who hasn't killed herself at least once, only to grow into someone needier? Who hasn't bent with her wounds to a mutinous patch, weeds shooting up like false rhubarb, every wisp, stem, and sodden pith a testament? Who hasn't scratched at the question of what it means to be here?
And that was The Weeds in This Garden, another poem from A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. Carrie, thanks so much. This has just been wonderful. I love your poems. And I love hearing you read them too. Thanks so much for joining us and for sharing your work.
Thank you for having me, Tim. And thank you so much for creating an opportunity for Appalachians to submit their work to Rattle. I just think that's a marvelous gift you are giving us. And I thank you for that.
Well, it's really my pleasure. I can't wait to read all the submissions that come in. So thank you, Carrie. And I'll have to talk to you more about it soon.
Okay. All
yeah,
right.
Have a good night.
Good night. All right. Bye.
Yeah, that was Carrie Gunter Seymour. You can find more of her work, of course, at Carrie Gunter Seymour poet.com. Her newest book, which just came out, is A Place So Deep Inside America It Can't Be Seen. From you can see the back here. It is a Sheila Nagig editions. I never know how to say that. Sheila Nagig, I think. And find it at Carrie Gunter Seymour poet.com. Her other book here is Serving, about being a mother of a son deployed in the Middle East. Two just wonderful books by Carrie Gunter Seymour. I'm so glad you could join us today, and so glad that you could too. Really moving poems. I really appreciated those. Now, we're going to move on to our open mic portion of the show. I'm not sure how many we'll have. Let's see, because I forgot to share the prompt last week. I did put it in the notes, so we'll see how many people actually read the notes. But last week's prompt was, let me put this on screen for everybody. Here we go. It was, write a poem based on a famous event that occurred in the year of your birth. Write a poem based on a famous event that occurred in the year of your birth. And that was the prompt for this week. We have a prompt every week and then an open mic for prompt poems as a way to encourage people to write poems, because that's one of the main things we want to do. We think writing poems is a magical, wonderful thing, and we want as many people to write poems as possible. So if you want to call in, you can call, oops, let me get rid of Carrie. Send your poem to openmic, all one word, at rattle.com. And then you can send me a chat message over Skype, Rattle Poetry, all one word, or give me a call at 818-850-7727. That's 818-850-7727. Let it ring a few times, and then hang up, and I will call you back when the time is right. So far we have like three or four people who have poems. Another, Michelle Parks, is calling in right now, so we have her up, ready to go. Now here was Megan's poem. Let me show this. This was Megan's poem. I didn't get to do a poem this week. I just ran out of time. This is the one week. Every season there's a week that's just too crazy for me, trying to put the next issue and chapbook together, which I did. I just sent it to our proofreaders at the post office an hour before showtime. So we're done with that, and we're ready to go for the fall issue and for the next chapbook. But I got home too late to write a poem, so I didn't write one. But here is Megan's. I'll tell you what I was going to write about. I was going to write about Mount St. Helens erupting, because that happened while I was being born. But I didn't get to it. But Megan was born in 1984, and this is her poem. San Ysidro, 1984. There's an epigram. The San Ysidro McDonald's Massacre was an act of mass murder which occurred at a McDonald's restaurant in the San Ysidro neighborhood of San Diego, California, on July 18th, 1984. My mother was 8 months pregnant with me. I wonder if she was eating a hamburger when she found out. The little disc-like ones, the same kind I would eat years later on one of those candy red stools, my little legs swinging. This was long before I had ever seen security footage of a high school cafeteria on an ordinary April day. And after we found out, my friends and I took my $800 car to where else? Because it was cheap and those hamburgers, indestructible as frisbees, hit the spot. This was still before I watched my oldest child, then two, twirl around the room while the TV poured out some mythical horror that we all thought would put an end to all this. Surely the slaughter of first graders would put an end to this all. Surely we could stop punctuating our lives with dates of gunfire and tearful press conferences. But it didn't, and we couldn't. And maybe that's why it was the first place I took my daughter afterward, why I placed her on a stool, bought her a happy meal, handed her the little toy, bright, plastic, indestructible. So that is Megan's poem. Again, she's a very good poet, so she just writes a good poem every week. San Ysidro, 1984, by Megan Green. That was her poem for the week. I didn't know about that. And also, I didn't know about that event from 1984. I also didn't know that she took our daughter to McDonald's after, what is it, the school shooting in wherever that was, Connecticut. Let's see who would like to go on the open mic now. We have Brent Stauffer. Let's call Brent up. Hey, Brent. How you doing tonight? Oh, I can't hear you. It's the same thing that happened last time. Let's see. I'll try to call you back in a little bit. We'll go to the next one down, and we'll call Brent back in just a minute. That happened last time. I'm not sure what it was, but he fixed it last time. Let us do... let's go to Michelle Parks.
Hello?
Hey, Michelle. How are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, it's always nice to see you. Hang on, I want to pull you in. So how you doing?
I'm Gouda.
So what did you write about for the prompt?
I'm trying to bring it up. I've had it up on my phone apparently so long that it timed out.
Oh yeah.
Oh, here it is. Okay. So I wrote about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Mm-hmm. It's always hard to say his last name. And Tucker in the chat was talking about so glad you are. Tucker and I met randomly in Pittsburgh a year ago for once and has been my friend ever since. And he is a beautiful person. But when I was 13 and 14, I was really into Vonnegut and Vonnegut promoted Solzhenitsyn. So I was reading really heavy, dense work, but it was so worthwhile. And in my birth year, 1974, his citizenship from the Soviet Union was revoked after he spent time in the gulags. Mm-hmm. Because of his controversial writing. I do feel I need to preface the poem with the definition Vujade. Vujade is something you've never experienced before that you kind of wake up to, like, wow, this is different. Hmm.
I've never heard that before. Interesting.
Yeah, I love it. It's the opposite of déjà vu.
Yeah. I don't know why it never occurred to me that there would be an opposite, but there is.
It's really, really weird. And I've never been able to fit it into a poem before, but it felt right. So I may still edit, but anyway.
Okay.
It's just called Solzhenitsyn. You tasted eyes, saw the depths of autonomy in a dystopian reality of a blind gulag. Is this Fujade? I cannot live on sight alone, though taste tickles throat. I am choking. I taste eyes that have seen madness. I become bitter. Meat and bone, I am designed to fail. Meat and bone, unnourished, slurped by masses. I am hungry still.
Wonderful. That was Solzhenitsyn by Michelle Parks. Thanks so much, Michelle. That was a wonderful poem. And I learned a new word, which I always love to do.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay. Let's go back to Brent and see if Brent fixed his microphone issue. And if anybody has any microphone problems ever, you know that I do every episode where I mute myself and forget. So, Brent, are you there? Can you hear me this time? Or can we hear you this time?
Yeah.
Ah, perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
We're back.
I'm here. No, I'm here. I'm here. I promise.
Okay, cool.
I promise I'm here. I'm right here.
We hear you. We hear you.
Hold on.
We see you. I think you flipped your camera. I see, like, the back of your...
See me.
There you go.
Okay, how's it?
That's perfect.
I am so sorry that this keeps happening.
No, it's no problem. As I was just saying before I called you, I mess up the microphone every single episode at some point. It's like it should be a drinking game or something. So I can't get mad at anybody for messing up the microphone. So what do you have for us? What did you write in the year of your birth?
Well, okay, I actually spent a lot of time looking at things that happened in 1966. And I was trying to find something that spoke to me, that made me want to write something. When I was a kid, I read a book by Richard Brautigan called The Abortion in Historical Romance, 1966. And I looked up when it was published, and it wasn't published till 71. But I found out that Brautigan went to Tijuana, Mexico to do research on this book in 1966. And so it's not technically a famous thing that happened in 1966, but it is a thing that happened in 1966, and I really wanted to write about
That's
it.
That's awesome. I think that counts. I think that counts.
Okay, great.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay. Richard Brautigan researches the abortion in Historical Romance, 1966. The slender author, famous mustache in tow, mid-March of 66, slouched south to haunt the alleys of Tijuana, Mexico. The hollow of the heel of his boot contained zero heroin, though in his wrinkled brain festered the germ of a glorious operation. You could say his novel was in the fetal stage. Vast shafts of sunlight lay across withered doorways. Dogs thin as ghosts dove in and out of the restless dust.
Very nice. That was Richard Brautigan researches the abortion and historical romance. I'm not familiar with that book. What is it about that book? Like, what is it about, and what does it move you so much about it?
Well, the first most superficial thing is that it's got the year of my birth in it, but it's it came out, I think, directly after Trout Fishing in America, but it. It's about a guy who works in a library, and in the library, the only books in the library are books that are unpublished, brought in by people who wrote them, and then he takes them and puts them where he thinks they ought to be, so they have to be unpublished though, and so it's a place for all these unread, unloved manuscripts to be.
Interesting.
And it's funny, there is a real life Brautigan library at a college somewhere, with about somewhere over 300 manuscripts or something that people have submitted that they've written and couldn't find a home.
Oh wow, that's
elsewhere.
That's really interesting.
And just generally as a teenager, reading Brautigan really stoked my imagination and gave me that feeling of like, I want to do that.
Yeah,
that's what I want to do. I want to make that feeling in people. That's, you know.
Very cool. Well, thanks for that recommendation. I have to check that out. That is The Abortion and Historical Romance, 1966 by Richard Brautigan. Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that. Yeah, appreciate it, Brent.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Yeah, have a good
appreciate
one.
It. Bye. You too. Bye.
Okay. Yeah, that was Brent Stauffer with his prompt poem. Let's see. Let's try Angela Gartner, see if she... We have women in the city, in a city.
Thank you so much.
Oh. Yeah, it's always tough to do the two things so quick. So how are you doing tonight, Angela?
Good, real good. We found like this enormous rat in our garage, so I'm thinking there's a poem somewhere in that.
Yeah, I'm always worried. We got dog food from Chewy. And they're selling like way more than like we imagined that we would need a lot more than we do. We have this like piles of dog food in bags and boxes. I'm so scared. We have nowhere else to put it because we're in California. There's no basement. There's no storage anywhere else. So I'm terrified of finding a whole bunch of rats eating the dog food. So I feel you.
Yeah, and it was he passed away. You know, just he nicely passed away. Hopefully heat stroke. I don't know. Anyway, I wrote this today, so hopefully it was okay. Because I saw the prompt, I'm like, oh, I can do that. It's about like, I was born in 1977, and in May of 1977, so I'm always, and that's the summer in New York where it had the blackouts and the sun. So I wrote this as a perspective of a woman in the city during that time and her feelings about all that and kind of intertwine some of the history and the of the blackouts and some other things. So I wrote this today, so we'll see. So
okay. Oh yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. And then I did this, it's the acoustic form. I'm trying to like learn more poetry forms. And so like, if you, the first letter of each of this is like it's Summer of a Killer. And it's like the first letter of that. Mm-hmm. So I try to do something different. Okay. Should I go out or stay to see another day? Under the lamps on the New York City streets, a man with ill intentions might be lurking for me. My long brown wispy hair blows around in the fan's wind. Electricity flickers as the summer's lightning storm begins. Reggie Jackson is on deck and swinging his bat, waiting to get in. Ominous feelings erupt in my being as a loud pop is heard. Far away from my apartment window, disco music is on the radio. A killer, he's somewhere. He's got a 44. Women, like me, are terror-stricken. Keep indoors, double-bolt your life, and don't walk alone at night. I look behind me without thinking, wondering if I should dye my locks blonde. Lights go out and the darkness trickles through the neighborhood well before dawn. Lovers kiss in a car. They didn't see the killer behind the door. Emotions rise. A city's filled with unrest as people feel weary from the dry, laden heat. Revolver is recovered from the son of Sam, who is arrested, and I can finally sleep.
Ah, thanks for sharing that. That was Woman in the City by Angela Gartner. Yeah, thanks for that. That was one crazy summer, wasn't it?
I was born in that. I'm the baby. I you know, we've lived in Ohio, and thank you for bringing on Carrie. She was amazing tonight.
She was, yeah. But
it's nice to hear a fellow Ohioan. But, you know, I've always been fascinated with New York City, and I was supposed to go there and write, and I was supposed to be a secretary and write my novel, but that never happened, so.
Well, you became a journalist. I know that now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for sharing that and joining us again, Angela.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Okay, we have one more person to do, I think. Let's see. We have a 978 number we'll call. This will be the last one for tonight. Then I have to put the kids to bed. Here we go. Let's see who this is. There's several different options. A few people sent poems but haven't called in. Let me see who this could be. The phone is ringing. Hey, this is Tim with Rattle. Did you want to share a poem?
Hi, yeah. This is Brenda Komarnski.
Hey, Brenda. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, good. Good.
So I have your poem here. It is The Year I Was Born, appropriately titled.
Born.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything you want to say about it before you read it?
Look, I had fun figuring out what all happened when I was born. So I was born in 1971, and I found out a few facts that I didn't know. So, and
Is there a website you went to or anything that you can to find
that
stuff?
I Googled what happened 1971. You know. So
let me pull up. I'm gonna hang on just 1 second while I put it up for everybody. Okay, we're good to go.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah.
The year I was born. The year I was born, Walt Disney World opened. I went just before this pandemic, a lifetime ago. The memory is too good to be real. The year I was born, women in Switzerland and 18-year-olds in the USA were allowed to vote. I just reminded my neighbor's son to go and register. Vote. Because our lives depend on it.
Awesome. Thanks so much. That was The Year I Was Born by Brenda Komarnski. Thanks so much for sharing that, Brenda. Yeah, yeah. So you were just at Disneyland? Or Disney World?
Disney World in Florida. And actually, my neighbor's son, it was a school trip.
Oh, yeah.
The orchestra competed, and he's in the orchestra. And so I was one of the chaperones, and yeah. And now he's graduated and just turned 18, so I'm like, yeah.
Well, it's nice to have one last hurrah while we can still do stuff like that,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Before everything closed.
Exactly, yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing that poem, Brenda, and have a great night.
All right, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, well, that is the show for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for joining us and sharing your poems. And I'm not going to forget to do the prompt this week. The prompt for next week is write a poem in the style of teaching someone how to do something. Write a poem in the style of teaching someone how to do something. That is next week's prompt. As always, write your prompt and then send it to that address on screen, openmic@rattle.com. And then you can call in over Skype or the phone, 818-850-7727, and read it for us. So once again, the prompt is, write a poem in the style of teaching someone how to do something. So a lesson poem. And that's your prompt for this week. Now, next week's guest on the Rattlecast is going to be Tom C. Hunley. His new book, you can't really read it on the screen, it's Here Lies, poems by Tom C. Hunley. And the poems, I think, I haven't read it yet, but I've read a bunch of these poems. It's they're all Here Lies. They're all sort of self-obituaries or something. They're really interesting poems. He's one of my favorite poets. He's the editor of Steel Toe Books. We've been publishing for a long time. Should be really fun to talk to him and share some of his great poems. So that is next Tuesday, July 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern, Tom C. Hunley. So join us then, and don't forget to do your prompt poem. So I will see you then. Hope you have a great week, and talk to you soon. Good night.